Good afternoon and welcome to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy, and we're just back from our August break and excited to be here. Today, our topic is foraging for wild edibles, from berries to mushrooms to greens. We've got a host of experts in the studio with us today, and I'm excited to tell you that we expect a phone call from Janice Schofield, who lives in New Zealand but heard about our show and said she wanted to listen in and maybe chime in a little bit. But in the studio with me today, I have Lori Constantino, a writer, editor, cook, and wild forager. You can find out more about Lori at her website at loriconstantino.com. Kate Moat, did I say that right, Kate?
Sure.
Is with the U.S. Forest Service Girdwood Office, and she's an expert on Alaska mushrooms. Christine Yee is from the Anchorage Korean community and an active local forager. Welcome, Christine.
Thank you.
And in addition to hearing from Janice Schofield, I think we're going to hear from Julie Riley, who's going to break from a class she's teaching on hardy Alaska vegetables to call in and give us a berry report. So I think berries are among the most popular things, and we should get a little insight as to how our berry crops are doing when Julie calls in. So we hope you have lots of questions about berries or mushrooms or greens, and maybe some stories about your own experiences as a forager. So I want you to think about giving us a call to ask your questions. We've got great experts in the studio. If you're in Anchorage, you can call 550-8433. If you're outside Anchorage, it's 1-888-353-5752. And we can take emails at hometown@alaskapublic.org. So to get started, actually, I wanted to read one quote, because as I was doing research for this, a lot of people said, foraging, you know, is that new, or, you know, what's it about? And I came across a quote from an essay by Jared Diamond. It's about agriculture, and it's called The Worst Mistake in the History of the Human Race. But at any rate, there's just one paragraph that might put foraging into perspective. And he imagines that someone from outer space is studying Earth and tries to put into perspective our hunter-gatherer behaviors with agriculture. And it's just one line that kind of sticks with you. And he said, if the history of the human race began at midnight, then we would now be almost at the end of our first day. We lived as hunter-gatherers for nearly the whole of that day, from midnight through dawn, noon and sunset. Finally, at 11:54 p.m., we adopted agriculture. So if you think hunter-gatherer or foraging is unusual, studies will tell you that human beings have foraged for about 196,000 years. So it's not a quirky new trend. It's something that's been around for a long time. So I want to go through our guests and just invite them to say hi and say a little bit about how they found their way into foraging. So how about we start with you, Lori?
In 1987, I moved to Greece, a rural Greek island, for a year with my husband. It's a subsistence agriculture community. And foraging is part of the way of life there. Everybody forages. I spoke no Greek at the time. And so I would go out with the women foraging and sorting the plants and cleaning them. And I learned how delicious they taste.
And before that, no foraging?
Well, I've always picked berries and, you know, done seashore foraging, but not for wild greens and certainly not for mushrooms. And so I learned a lot about the plants there. And when I came back to Alaska, I started learning about the plants here and just kept foraging.
Okay. How about you, Christine?
Yeah, I come over also 1983, and I with my family. And that time I was much wild stuff, but people say wild thing is really good. So I try. It was good. So since then, I really pick them most if I know things, and I pick them all. And if I don't know, I try not to pick them, because a lot of things is poison. So if you're not so sure, just leave alone. And also, my mother always have growing or wild things when I grew up. So I watch her doing it. So I learned from her. And now I'll go by myself everywhere and pick them, veggies and also berries and go fishing and all those kind of things. I enjoy so much.
Living off the land. Yeah. I was so happy to have you as a guest because always on the bike trails and at Kincaid, I see so many groups of Asian women picking, and I've never really been able to ask them, you know, is there something special they're picking? So I'm really thrilled to have you on the show. So thank you for
thank
coming
you.
Today. How about you, Kate? How did you find your way? And you're sort of our mushroom expert today. So right. How did you find your way into foraging?
Well, oddly enough, I got into mushrooms at a young age, and I did not like to eat them. I would pick them off my pizza, but I found them really kind of intriguing and mystical and strange how they'd spring up out of the ground in the fall. And I got more into the taxonomy and learning to identify them and their different types. And just from learning from professors that certain ones are edible, I decided to be bold and try a couple and found them to be far superior than the store-bought varieties.
Hmm. So did you actually study them academically?
I did.
Because they're very involved.
Yes.
Yeah. So, I mean, did you get a degree in mushrooms?
Yeah, I did a master's in plant science, but my focus of study was fungi associated with white bark pine down in Montana.
Wow. Okay, very interesting. So today was sort of a drizzly, rainy day, and I wondered, was it a good day for foraging? What do you think, Lori? Is it a day you'd go out, or is it a day you'd avoid?
I'd go out in a heartbeat. Mm-hmm. In fact, I went out yesterday in Homer where it was pouring down rain.
Okay.
The mushrooms like the water, and they start coming up, and I'd also rather be in the rain than in the sun.
Mm-hmm. It's cooler.
It's cooler. It's more pleasant.
Yeah, yeah. How about you, Christine?
Raining day, it doesn't bother me at all.
Okay, so we have hardy characters. Kate, I wondered, is it it's better for mushrooms to pick
up? Well, certainly, yeah, they need the moisture to spring up. But, you know, rain can make them a bit soggy. However, I mean, we're in Alaska. You can't be a chooser on rainy day.
Yeah, sometimes you just have to get out there no matter what. I know, that's
absolutely.
What I always say. It's Alaska. You do it anyway. What, Lord?
Well, the other thing I've found with mushrooms and you can tell me if I'm wrong about this, but it seems like if you go in the morning, you can, and especially go over and over to the same place in the morning, you can get there when the mushrooms have not been infested by bugs and are not soggy and are firm and nice.
Absolutely. Yeah, morning's better. And they do spring up overnight.
Oh, okay.
You can visit the same spot 24 hours later and still do quite well.
Wow.
I literally had a 1 pound, 10 ounce mushroom in my front yard, King Bolete porcini spring up overnight. It was amazing.
Oh my gosh. I was walking on my front lawn yesterday and seeing all kinds of little ones and then some of those really orange ones with the white sprinkles. Yeah, not good ones. I didn't eat anything because I don't know anything, so I'm not gonna do that. So foragers go out no matter what in the weather. That's good. How about there's some issues around this. Like I've read a lot online about ethical issues. And I guess I'd just like to, like there's ways of doing it that do no damage, I guess. And I'd kind of like to explore that. Does that bring things to mind for you guys?
Well, don't overharvest.
Yeah.
For one thing, I mean, fiddleheads is a classic example. You should never take more than three of the fiddleheads from a plant mm-hmm. or it will damage the plant.
You know, I've heard people say about that they'd given up on fiddleheads because there's some that aren't, some kind of fern fiddleheads that are not good and some that are good. Is there an easy way to know you've got the right kind?
Well, I'll answer and then maybe Christine has something to say.
She's shaking her head.
Yes, you can tell there's a difference. And one is you don't want to pick is too much that fudge on it. And then that thing is not good. They are very, when you want to eat them, it's very chewy, very, very hard. But it has green and has kind of a black fudge a little bit on it.
That Did one you say is black? What was that word, black?
Fudge.
Foot.
Uh-huh.
Oh, black.
Fudgy.
Foot.
Kind of like a feather thing.
Okay. Uh-huh. Okay.
And that one is kind of tender and really good. Like American people, they eat that fiddle part. And Oriental people, they throw away fiddle part.
Really?
Yeah. We like just steam.
The stem.
Uh-huh. And then we are, you keep the years, you bring home and blanch them. We most blanch them everything. And blanch them and dry them. Very good dry at the sun. And then you keep the years, even 10 years, still good.
Wow, that's the stem of the fiddlehead, huh?
Yeah. And Oriental people, I never see anybody really eat that fiddle part.
Huh.
Because they say slimy.
Kind slimy? Of. Slimy? Yeah. Kate, do you even do fiddles? Fiddlehead?
Yeah, sometimes.
Yeah, just kind of casually?
Right, yeah. If I have a time.
You sound very serious about it, Christine. How about you, Lori? What were you going to say?
I was going to say that bracken ferns are associated with stomach cancer in some research, and so eating a lot of them is probably not a good idea. The easiest way, I think, to identify ferns, which ferns are good and which ones aren't, is the same answer for all the other wild plants. Go out now, because field guides have usually mature specimens of the plants in them, and they tell you about the mature plant, and when you want to harvest them is when they're small and babies and very immature. So go out now, find your spots, write them down, and go out in the spring to accurately get what you're trying to harvest.
That's a great advice. Well, I want to welcome Janice Schofield onto the show. Hi, Janice.
Hello. It's so good to be with you.
And you are calling us from New Zealand, right?
I am.
And if our listeners aren't aware of you, I consider you one of the sort of first and founding, you know, sort of members of the foraging world. I referred to your book, Wild Plants, Discovering Wild Plants, and your field guide to Alaska Wild Plants. So it's really lovely to have you on, and you're in tune here with a trio of other experts in our studio. I don't know, did you hear their introduction?
No, I didn't.
Okay, well, let me just let you know. We have Lori Constantino, who's of Anchorage, who learned how to forage in Greece when she went there and didn't speak Greek, but went out with locals and learned a whole lot and carried it back in her life when she came back to Alaska. Christine Yee's with the Korean community here and is a longtime forager. And I've always seen Asian women harvesting, and I've always wanted to hear from them, and I'm so thrilled that she's on our show today. And we have Kate Moet, who's from the U.S. Forest Service and really knows a whole lot about mushrooms. And we were just talking a little bit about how people got into it. And I guess I'll throw that question to you, Janice. How did you actually get into foraging?
Well, briefly, I grew up 40 miles north of Boston, and I grew up at a time when there were still little patches of undeveloped house lots, and they were my mini wilderness. And I just always found myself with a passion for the wild plants and the praying mantis and all the little roadside weeds and all the things that grew in those areas. And I would always be bringing things back home, like, what's this and what can I do with it? And I'd be told, like, I don't know, don't put it in your mouth. But I still had that passion and that interest. And it was really when I got to Alaska and started living at Swift Creek, the head of the bay, and over at Rocky River, that I really had a driving need to know, one, for things that I could use to eat, one, I could use for things to take care of ourselves. And I started meeting people and also finding that Alaska really didn't have any kind of comprehensive book about the plants, and that was what led me into discovering wild plants and meeting all kinds of plant people. But I actually later learned that my when I brought my dad up and I was showing him plants, that he was saying, like, oh, this is a plant my mother used to use. And it turned out that grandmother, who I never met, was an herbalist. So I guess you could say it was in my genes, and it just took Alaska to wake it up.
Oh, that's great. I'm just going to throw our phone number out to folks, because we've got some great foraging experts, mushrooms, greens, berries. So if you're interested, give us a call at 550-8433 or 1-888-353-5752, or you can shoot us an email to hometown@alaskapublic.org. So we were just sort of getting into some of the ethical dilemmas of foraging, and Lori was just talking about, you know, sparing the plant. You were talking about fiddleheads and taking no more than three, I think is what I've read. How about with mushrooms, Kate? What do you think about the ethics of hunting mushrooms?
Sure. Well, mushrooms are different. They're not plants. They're kind of analogous to an apple. on a tree. Mm. It's the fruiting body or that the underground fungus produces. So when you're picking the mushroom, you're really not harming the fungus below it. Of course, they advise that you take care not to disturb the duff layer or the mycelium below your feet. But most of the mushrooms that you harvest to eat here in Alaska aren't, it doesn't appear to be that they're affected much by harvesting.
So there's not a danger of over-harvesting.
Right.
Yeah.
There's been some concern in the past about, well, aren't you reducing your spore bank by taking specimens that maybe haven't produced their spores yet? And that just doesn't really appear to be the case.
Okay, so you can feel a little less concerned about mushrooms. Lori, go ahead.
I have a question for Kate. And that is, there was a woman named Phyllis Kempton who is a really big mushroom expert in Alaska. And I learned how to forage from her. And she always said to harvest all of the underground portion of boletes because otherwise it can rot and damage the mycelium. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I've heard that as well. And that's something I do is another good reason to do that is if you're cutting them off at the base, you're missing out on a good chunk of the mushroom that you're leaving below ground. So how I harvest, say, king boletes is I'll pick the whole thing out of the ground and just gently shave the dirt off the base of it.
Hmm.
So you're not wasting anything.
All right. We've got a caller, so I just want to welcome Pamela onto Hometown Alaska. Hi, Pamela.
How are you?
I'm great. What's your question?
Well, I'd like to know the book on Alaska as far as harvesting mushrooms and other plants. And I would like to know, are there classes or tours for beginners?
Okay, good. We'll kind of do the circuit here. I think I'm going to ask Janice, what's your favorite book? You've written several. So what's your favorite book on learning how to do mushrooms, greens, just picking? What would you say, Janice?
Well, Discovering Wild Plants was written because it was the best way. There's two ways that you write books. One is because you're an expert, and the other is because you're learning. And people learn as you go. And the book was like a 7-year journey. And my greatest frustration in the beginning trying to learn was finding books that had just a line drawing or a photo just at one stage. And that's why that was written. You know, so that's one guide that I think is good, but I also highly encourage people to, you know, take classes, and there's a number of people, and, you know, there can be some other thoughts from the panel, but in Homer, Nancy Lee Evans is one person that's teaching a lot of classes, and, you know, highly recommended.
Yeah. I just want to break in here and say to our listeners, if you hear the names of books and classes, we on alaskapublic.org, if you'll look on the homepage there, we've got an entry on Hometown Alaska introducing today's show. And if you click on the headline, it's going to open up a story, and we have lots of links. We have links to Lori's site. We have a PDF of Alaska Mushrooms from the U.S. Forest Service. We have listings of good books there, and we are listing a class of Nancy Lee Evans. So that's a really good place. So go to alaskapublic.org. You don't have to try to drive and write at the same time. So Lori, what do you think? What do you think about resources and learning?
Well, I think without question, the only decent book about Alaska wild plants is Janice's.
Mm-hmm.
So
Discovering Wild Plants.
When I give classes, I encourage people to buy it. There's a book that they're selling at Costco now called The Boreal Herbal. That's a Canadian publication that's also very good. But If you don't have Janice's book and you want to go foraging, you're making a mistake.
You should start with, and I think, Janice, you told me you have a new edition that it should be easy to find. I struggled to find it in the library. It was always checked out. And eventually they went into storage and pulled one out of storage for me so I could read it. But it sounds like we've got them in town. Go ahead, Laura.
We have them in town. And then for classes, I teach foraging classes in Anchorage. In the spring, I do foraging walks with people, and I can be contacted through my website.
Yeah, and I know that the Cooperative Extension Service, we put their website on our list of links because I was just over there the other day. They had a wild berry class that was really differentiating between bane berries and other red berries, and talking about when things are ripe and all of that. So they're a great resource. They've got handouts. Many of their handouts are free. Sometimes there's a small charge for their handouts. They've got a berry cookbook that looks really good. So, there's some really good local resources. How about mushrooms? What would you say, Kate? What's a good source for that?
Well, there's the brochure that you just mentioned that Steve Trudell and I wrote. It was published last year. It's free. You can pick it up at any Forest Service office, or you can find a PDF of it online. There's a number of great books that cover Alaska. Mushrooms of the Pacific Northwest by Steve Trudell is an excellent resource for this
area.
Who
is Steve Trudell?
Steve Trudell is a mycologist out of Washington, and he actually comes up every year and helps me put on the Girdwood Fungus Fair.
Right, we have a link to that, which is coming up, the dates are...
The Fungus Fair is the 22nd through the 24th this year in Girdwood. This is the seventh year we've been doing it, and it's an excellent opportunity to learn your mushrooms. We have mushroom display tables set up in the community room, so you can just walk through, and everything's labeled right there for you. There's also a number of mushroom walks. Unfortunately, they're all sold out this year already.
which speaks to the popularity of this issue, but both mushrooms and wild plants. And Janice said to me something last night. We were chatting by Skype from New Zealand that just the intense, I think it was Nancy Lee Evans, the intense interest of people, partly a food security issue. People want to be close to where their food sources are, but also just kind of more understanding of the natural world, I think.
Right, absolutely.
So high demand of the mushroom fungus fair classes. Lori, what were you going to say?
I was going to say that there's also the element of seasonality. And in the world today, when you can buy corn in the middle of winter and, strawberries when it's icy out, we really don't have seasonal food except for foraged food. The only time you can get it is the brief period of time when it's available. And I think people really resonate with that.
Which makes it special because you can't get it on demand. You can only get it, and you have to go out and work for it, too. I'm going to welcome Chris onto the show. Chris, you're listening to Hometown Alaska. What's your question?
Well, I just wanted to clarify something. I know a little bit less about mushrooms than your expert, heard your expert say that she recommended pulling the mushroom out of the ground. My cousin and I were set on, in Wisconsin, we were set on taking down a dead oak tree on their property, and we stepped over the barbed wire fence that separated us from the tree and then noticed what ended up being 28 pounds of white morels.
Wow, and, well done. Excellent.
Better to be lucky than smart. But in Wisconsin, and I'm not sure how many states do this, you can harvest wild mushrooms, take them to a state-run stand. They'll pay you for them and then resell them to restaurants and others, around the country. Well, the first batch we brought in, we had plucked out of the ground, and the woman looked at them and said, okay, when you go back to get the rest of them, make sure you slice them at the base. Don't pull them all the way out of the ground because you may keep that mushroom from regrowing. And so just wanted to clarify. Now I'm getting two messages, and I'm not sure which one is the better advice.
Sure. That's a really common misconception, and there's really not any data that supports that being the case. Okay, they've done a number of studies in the Pacific Northwest looking at impacts of mushroom harvesting, and they tried different techniques such as cutting it off at the base or plucking them out of the ground, and they really found no difference in long-term productivity. So
good. Chris, I'm glad you asked that because I bet a lot of other people have heard that over the years, and it's kind of nice to get an answer.
And my first thought when that woman maybe had mentioned that to you was that perhaps the mushrooms were covered with dirt, and that's why she suggested you cut the bottoms off or cut them off at the base, because mushrooms are a real pain to clean. And so as clean as you can pull them out of the field, the better.
Okay, good to know. Thanks for your time.
Okay. Go ahead, Lori.
And the other thing along with that, for mushrooms, I strongly recommend that people field dress them right at the time of harvest. And by that, I mean when you pluck it out of the ground, take a knife and shave off the outside of it. Because then when you put it in your harvesting basket, it doesn't shower the rest of the mushrooms in the basket with dirt. It's really important to work clean, in my opinion.
Okay, okay, so Kate's shaking her head. So, Christine, I wanted to jump back to you and say, where did you learn how you, I think you, in the early remarks, you mentioned your mother, but are you completely sort of word of mouth, community information sharing? Is that where you've got most of your information, or do you do research?
I do research by myself, and I learn by myself, because when you go out and you don't know, and people pick it up and asking, they're not going to tell you because they want to keep them secretly.
Oh, yes. So, yeah. That was one of the topics we wanted to touch
on. Especially mushroom place, they're never going to take you there because mushroom is not too much out there. So people, they picked their own, like in the morning, they go early. And they picked it up.
And they never will tell you where
they never tell you. And when they bring it, give you some if you wanted to, but they're not going to take you there.
Yeah.
So, but I learned by myself.
People are going to say to me, when are you going to ask these experts their favorite spots? and we did talk about this early on, and I think Lori has an answer, you know.
Well, at least for berries.
Yes, she has a great answer. Which
I said go up on the hillsides where there aren't trees, because the ground is usually covered with them. No devil's club, no cow parsnip, no trees, where you're up in the low,
you know. And they need sunshine, too, right, to ripen?
They do.
So that would help?
Yes.
Yeah. How about you, Christine? Where do you like to go get what you get? Berries?
Well, yeah. When I picked the blueberries, I didn't know around Anchorage, so I went to Broad Pass near Fairbanks.
Oh, Broad Pass on the way to Denali National Park. Yeah.
So
that's above tree line and sweeping landscape. Yeah.
That's right. So I went there last year, and there is lot of berries. If you go early, if somebody didn't pick them yet, but if you a little bit late, already gone all because everybody stopped by there.
Well, I'm hoping that we're going to get a little report from Julie Riley of the Cooperative Extension Service about whether she thinks they're ripe. Although, actually, earlier today we also talked about the picking that people are already doing in this room. How about you, Laura? You had some astounding numbers.
Well, a group of friends went picking recently, and
Like 2 days ago or 2 weeks ago?
Sunday. Okay. And got 5 gallons of blueberries in Anchorage.
In Anchorage. Okay. And you had, did you have one, Christine?
Yes, I went Monday, Arctic Valley.
Arctic Valley?
Uh-huh.
And did you find the berries to be good?
Yes, they have a lot of berries and then everywhere and tons of people.
Oh, people are out. They're on to it.
Yeah, okay. Whole family coming together, kids and most Americans.
Yes.
And I picked up a gallon.
A gallon? Uh-huh. Okay.
Was really good.
Good. I'm going to welcome another caller to the show. Natasha, welcome to Hometown Alaska. What's your question?
Well, hi, thanks. I just wanted to say, Lori, I'm a big fan. I read your blog a lot.
Thank you.
I've been, my family and I have been picking bolete mushrooms basically my entire life, and I just wanted to make a little comment about mushrooms location secrecy.
That was also one of our topics.
my comment is boletes really need to be picked right when they come out of the ground. So I'm not as strict about keeping my location secret because I feel like people can pick in the same spots relatively close to one another in time and still be able to get a great harvest.
Well, that's great. Kate, what do you say to that?
Can you call me later and tell me where that is?
Sure, I'd be happy. You can find it on my blog.
What's your blog?
My blog is Alaska Knit Nat, KNITNAT, and I have a very extensive guide on picking boletus mushrooms, and I do mention Lori in there and how she says, don't pick your mushrooms with plastic bags. Don't store your mushroom in plastic bags.
I read that. What do you guys recommend? Kate, what's the best stuff to use?
Either wicker basket or paper bags work great.
Mm-hmm.
The plastic kind of turns the mushrooms to mush.
Goopy?
Yes.
Yeah, slimy. How about you, Christine? What do you use?
I didn't pick the mushrooms at all.
Oh,
so
okay.
I don't know.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, how about you, Lori?
I use wicker basket.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm gathering something that I'm not absolutely positive about, that I want to look at some of my resources when I get home, I segregate them in brown paper bags.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, especially since if the cap separates from the stem, you really don't know where that mushroom might be coming from.
Ooh, okay.
Yeah, you absolutely do not want to mix collections in one basket if you're not quite certain of identities.
So a separate bag for every type of mushroom? I mean, something like that?
If you're uncertain or if you're trying a new mushroom for the first time, you know, people have mushroom allergies just like they do to everything else. So something listed as edible could cause gastric upset to some. Mm-hmm. So you want to, you know, use caution the first time you're trying a mushroom. Morels, mm-hmm. for example, about 25% of the nation's poisoning cases are from morel mushrooms. And I personally can't eat them.
They also need to be cooked.
Raw morels
will make you sick.
And so can cooked morels if you're susceptible. Yeah.
You can attest to that.
Yes, I can.
And along those lines, people have a lot of allergies to wild plants, too. So a really important rule that I encourage people to follow is that if you've never eaten a wild plant before, eat a small quantity rather than a whole lot of it to see if it agrees with you.
Good thoughts and good advice.
That's very true for mushrooms as well.
As well. We need to take a little break here, and I just want to remind our listeners we're talking about foraging. We have some fabulous guests in the studio. We've got Lori Constantino, Christine Yee, and Kate Moat. And on the line from New Zealand, we have Janice Schofield. And Janice, when we come back, I want to talk to you a little bit about invasive plants and foraging and how those two things come together, because we had an interesting conversation about that. And so when we come back, we'll talk there. I'm Kathleen McCoy, and you're listening to Hometown Alaska.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Hometown Alaska on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. I'm Kathleen McCoy, your host, and today we're talking about foraging for berries, for mushrooms, for wild greens. And I just want to remind you of our guests in the studio. We've got Christine Yee from the Korean community, a longtime harvester, Kate Moat from the Forest Service, who is something of a mushroom expert and has worked on a brochure that features Alaska's mushrooms. We have Lori Constantino, who's a forager and a cook and a writer. And on the line from New Zealand, we have Janice Schofield, the author of Discovering Wild Plants. And Janice, I think you heard me before the break. We had this interesting discussion about invasive plants and your sensibilities about that. Could you kind of boil that down and let people know your thoughts about that as it relates to foraging?
Okay. Well, when I started foraging in Alaska, I learned, you know, not only about the native plants, which I highly value, but also that a lot of the plants that we have that are some of our most useful plants are plants that either came deliberately or indeliberately with immigrants to the country. So we actually have our biodiversity is actually a biodiversity of all kinds of plants, both the plants that we perceive of native, but I'm finding more and more that native is simply a snapshot in time. And it's like trying to lock things in, like, oh, if they come in after that date, now they're an immigrant. But when you find the native plants, they have all different entry periods into the country. And I found that a lot of times that the plants that grow around people grow in disturbed soil. Sometimes people go, oh, that's an invasive plant, that's the enemy. And I've had so many people that have done major turnarounds looking at things in their own yard and going, oh, wow, I've got this. Oh, I was trying to get rid of that. I was trying to kill it. I was trying to poison it. And now I'm realizing, wow, what an incredible healing plant that is. So a lot of these plants have a long history of association with people. It doesn't mean that sometimes something might not become out of balance, but I think we really have to tread with caution because a lot of these plants only survive in disturbed areas that people have had, and I'm seeing a huge
experience. Like, for example, here in New Zealand, in a week, we're scheduled to get 28,000 hectares around us all poisoned with one of the world's most lethal poisons, and that's going to be an end to all my foraging for at least 9 months. So I'm seeing that there's a caution that people have in really evaluating, like, what is this plant? And I think one of the best ways to control this plant, if you want to look in that way, is by foraging it. And if it's something you really want to keep from spreading, then you harvest it more heavily. But I think we have to really be cautious that this doesn't just end up being, oh, whatever the pest of the week is, and that it just becomes a broad-scale blanket.
Okay.
For starting to use poisons. So that's it.
Okay, thanks. I thought it was a perspective I hadn't heard before. I want to throw out our phone numbers to our listeners, 550-8433. 1-888-353-5752. And by the way, I have a couple of emails coming in, and we're going to get to those as soon as we can. But I mean, I just wanted to get our listeners, our experts in the studio, if they have any thoughts about that. And if you don't have a thought about it, don't feel that you have to say anything. I would thought it was interesting to hear Janice's take on it, since she's a premier forager, but also is having some reaction to the invasive species activities. Do you have anything to say, Lori?
Well, the invasive species that I harvest a lot are things like dandelions and nettles, and I think the more you can harvest them, the better.
It's kind of what she said, you
right.
know, if you don't want it around, harvest it.
The species I don't harvest, I mean, species that are edible and good are things like chocolate lilies or rose root that are edible, but they don't grow in such huge populations, and I don't harvest them as a matter of choice, because I don't want to damage the population.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How about you, Kate?
Well, boy, I think I could talk on the subject
four,
for a couple hours
programs.
Because my major duties at the Forest Service are invasive plant management.
Okay.
But something that came to mind that's really relating to this topic today is there's some research being done up at UAF in Fairbanks on the interactions between invasive species competing for pollinators with native berries. And specifically, they're looking at, is white sweet clover pulling pollinators away from berries in the area? So I don't know. There's
a different perspective. Yeah. So I don't know that we have an answer here today. I mean, if any of our listeners are interested and want to weigh in, give us a call. But I'm actually going to move on to a couple of emails that came in. First one is a mushroom question for you, Kate. Is there a general way to tell if a mushroom is toxic? I worry about my animals snarfing one up.
The only way to know if a mushroom is edible or poisonous is to know exactly what species it is. And that's interesting she brought up her animals, because last week I had two calls in a row about dog poisonings.
Oh.
I'm on the national identifiers list for poisonings, and a dog had eaten an Ammonita muscaria, which is the red mushroom with white dots, which caused the dog to act quite drunk and obviously very concerned the owners, which can be very toxic to dogs. Luckily, I think the dog survived, but there are certainly other lawn mushrooms that could be out now that are lethal to animals.
If your animal starts to be, you think they might have eaten them and they start to behave weird, is there some remedy?
The number one most important thing you can do is figure out what mushroom that they ate. And I realize most people probably won't be able to identify them, but collect them, bring them to the vet with you. That'll really help a lot in the treatment. There's a lot of different mushroom toxins, and the treatment is really going to depend on what toxin that dog ate.
That's really valuable, because, I mean, the way we walk our dogs in big open parks, you know, Kincaid, I'm thinking, and up in the Chugach, I mean, they're probably encountering, I just really hadn't thought about that before. It was a really good question, I think.
Yeah, and one of the more common poisonings is with the Ammonita muscaria, because it has a fishy odor.
Which would attract a dog.
Right.
Yeah, okay. And we're right in the season right now, right?
Yes, they're out like crazy.
Okay, so bear that in mind. Could you just give us a description of it one more time? That
yeah,
might be helpful?
So it's one of the more easily recognizable mushrooms in Alaska, and it's very common. It's got a red cap with white dots on the cap.
Okay.
And a white stem. It has a ring around the stem and a cup at the base.
Mm-hmm.
they start out maybe a couple inches, and then they grow up. They can be quite tall, up to, I've seen them over a foot high.
So bear that in mind when you're out walking your dog. Steer them away from mushrooms that look like that.
And especially the little brown ones. The little brown ones have amatoxins that can cause liver failure.
Oh, not good.
No.
And so those are tiny? They're smaller?
They're smaller, yep.
And are they clustered together? Or?
They can grow singly or in clusters. Okay. I get a big flush of them in my yard every fall in the wood chips.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Okay.
But don't fear all little brown mushrooms. There's just a couple species that have the amatoxins.
So as we have been saying all through the hour, know what you have in your hand before you be sure of it. Don't be guessing at it. So I've got one more email that we'll just go ahead and take from Gail. I'm interested in knowing about picking berries that are not quite ripe. Will they ripen after being picked? I have the chance to go berry picking in a remote area and have one shot to go. And I want to know if it is okay to pick the berries that are not ripe.
No.
There's one clear answer. Lots of shaking heads here in the room, Gail. It's not going to work. It's no remedy. You have to be there. Like you said, timing is everything. Yeah. Okay.
And honestly, when I want something that I know is coming into season, I go every single day to check out my spots to see when they're going to be ready.
Oh.
Because as Christine said, a lot of people go to the same places, and so you want to harvest them when they're ripe, but before everybody else comes.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, let's continue. I'm going to throw out our number one more time, 550-8433 in Anchorage, or 1-888-353-5752, or do send us an email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. So anyway, I was kind of working my way. We wanted to talk about education. We talked about, you know, don't go out there without knowing what you're doing. Field guides, we've talked a little bit about both Janice's very helpful field guides. I know, Lori, you have a really interesting thing on your website, the ethics, and there were a couple of really good points. We've touched on some of them, like, you know, sustainable harvesting. I don't know. I'm trying to think. Do you've got that list in your brain?
Well, I have some in my brain, but I think the most important one, no matter what species it is, if you have any doubt whatsoever, if you don't absolutely positively know what something is, don't eat it.
We can't say that enough. And we've said we're going to say it over and over. So if you're just tuning in, you're going to hear it.
Don't go on private land. And also in some parks, it's illegal to harvest. So be aware that you have permission to be where you are, and it's a safe place to be. I don't harvest within 75 feet of a roadway because I don't want the fumes, and the exhaust and dust and all that. Don't harvest in areas where there's dogs randomly using it to go to the bathroom. Be aware of
common sense.
Yeah, common sense.
Yeah. Actually, Julie Riley has called in to give us a little bit of a berry report. Julie, I know you're teaching a class, so I want to get to you quickly and let you tell us what you've got to say about berries.
Well, I think it's a great year for berries, especially blueberries. The common places to pick around Anchorage are, you know, up in the Chugach and driving north to Hatcher Pass and down to Girdwood. A lot of people go to Arctic Valley. So the best tip is to, you know, get off the beaten path a little ways so you can find a spot that's not been picked over. But even a week ago down in Girdwood, the Moose Meadow, which gets accessed by lots of folks, had blueberries right at the entrance.
There you go. So it might not be there by today, though, or right after this show. Right. So it's a good year. Have you been out picking yet, Julie?
I've done blueberries, and I was out searching for raspberries earlier, but I was foiled on that one.
Okay.
So we still have there are cranberries that are just starting to ripen up in wooded areas, and the Lobush cranberry. It's going to be in most locations a little bit longer, just, you know, depends on what elevation you're picking at, but that's one of the latter berries to ripen.
And for people who are, you know, watching and trying to figure out when is it a good year, did we have the right combination of sun and rain? Is that what's giving us a good year, or was it lots of bee pollination? I mean, what do you think it was?
Yeah, I think that pollination is really important, so it depends on what the weather is like when the berries are flowering. And some of our wild berries flower very early. The currants and the blueberries flower very early. And so our native bees need to be out there and really working. And if it's cold and rainy, there's not as much activity, but the our native Alaskan bees, fly when it's much cooler than when honeybees are willing to go out and pollinate. So it has to do with pollination, and it does also have to do with moisture and sunshine. Maybe I would think that would affect how early they're ripening, compared to a year without a lot of sunshine. I think, we've had good sunshine this year, even though there has been quite a bit of rain.
I have some domesticated raspberries in my yard, and I'm always watering them, imagining it's going to make them plumper, but I don't know if that really helps or not.
It does, because I've had patches that I didn't water, that I, just let nature take care of it, and there's a big difference.
And here's a question I heard in your class the other day at the Cooperative Extension Service. A woman asked if you have to wash your raspberries, that might be a question other people have. What was the answer?
Well, Leslie Shellcross, who's home economist for Cooperative Extension Service in Anchorage, her recommendation was not to wash them. If they seem dusty, certainly you can go ahead and do that. But raspberries are very perishable, and so her recommendation was not to wash them.
Okay. All right. Is there anything else? I know you're going back to teaching, so anything else you want to leave us with, Julie?
Well, we're lucky to live in Alaska, because I don't know of any other place where there are so many wild berries out there that you can harvest all the way from early July, through up until frost time.
Yeah. I'm going to throw out our number just in case anybody has a question for you, 550-8433 in Anchorage. I don't know, I guess I wanted to alert people that we've got the Cooperative Extension Service website on alaskapublic.org. And I was there the other day picking up, flyers on red raspberries and blueberries and just all kinds of really free and good information. So if you're new to berry picking, that's a good place to start. Okay, well, Julie, thank you so much for taking the time to call in. I really appreciate it. I think I was sure that telling people there would be a berry report might snag us a few listeners, and I think it did. So thank you so much.
Thanks, Kathleen.
All right, take care and good luck in your class.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So I'd say to my panel of experts, what haven't we covered yet? Something I found online was pace yourself. Does that ring a bell with you? If you don't know it, don't eat it. We've said that. So I don't know how that's pacing yourself. When you're trying new foods, go slowly. That's it.
Go slowly. And the other thing is, some things are edible. I'll give you chickweed as an example. It's very edible. People put it raw in salads. Uh-huh. But it's a big pain in the butt to clean.
Why is that?
Because it's all segmented and it's tiny little leaves and it gets dirt in it. So to
you
get
really
it clean,
gotta
it's
wash
a,
it.
A pain. And so I think what I was trying to convey is that if it's the first time you're harvesting something and you don't know if you're going to like it or if it's worth the effort, just do it in a small quantity first. And then you can go all out and harvest anything mm-hmm. you see.
Yeah. By the way, do you have to wash mushrooms as much?
Well, you don't want them to get soggy. So how I clean mushrooms is I use a damp paper towel and just gently clean the dirt off
okay.
that way.
You have to like dirt a little bit, I think. No? You can't be too averse to
well,
it. Yeah.
Oh, and actually that's a good point, too. The other thing that happens with mushrooms is that they get invaded by insects very easily. And so King Bolete's porcini have little wormy things inside of them. And if you buy them dried from Italy, you can see that they've dried them and you can see all the holes in it. So they don't discard that because they say that when they dry them, the process, the bugs fall out of them. Me, I'm really particular. I don't keep those portions.
Ah. So if it was good enough for a bug, it was good enough for a human, I guess.
Well, you just need, and you need to deal with it right away because when they have wildlife, if you will, in them, they continue to eat and propagate, and you want to get rid of those as soon as possible.
Yeah.
So don't harvest too many that you can't process them at the, you know, at the time that you gather them, immediately when you get home.
Good point.
Yeah, you want to slice them in half right away. If you let them sit in the fridge overnight whole, and if they have those wormholes in them, they can be decimated by the morning.
Oh, okay, slice them in half.
Slice them. I actually slice them into many thin slices so that you make sure you get them all.
Okay. And is that worm bad if you ingest it, or?
No, it's extra protein.
Okay.
That's what my husband says.
I'm going to welcome Joan on the show. Joan, welcome to Hometown Alaska. You've got a question about berries.
I did. Somebody was talking about collecting 5 gallons worth of berries, and that sounded like then they used one of those berry pickers in order to get that many. And if so, how the heck do they get them clean?
That was you, Lori, that got 5 gallons?
It was a short share. It was a group of people who got it, and some people were using pickers and some people weren't. I mean, I clean berries by putting them on a cookie sheet with a towel on it and put them at one end and tip up the cookie sheet, and then the berries roll down and the leaf and debris stay at the top.
Oh, that's a nice tip. Do you use one of those claws to?
I don't.
No, okay. All right. All right.
All right. So you don't get very many on a cookie sheet at one time. Otherwise, you're not going to get that effect, I assume.
No, and that's the whole thing about foraging. The foraging is the easy part. The difficult is the cleaning, whether it's dandelions or mushrooms or berries. Processing them and cleaning them is the time-consuming part.
Yeah, I like picking them clean then. Okay. Thanks very
thanks,
much.
Joan.
Bye.
I wanted to, actually, Christine, we were talking about dandelions, and when I talked with you before the show, you talked about using so much of the dandelion that I thought it might be nice to hear you talk. You use the crown, you use the leaves, you use the root. Could you talk a little bit about how you use the dandelion?
Yeah, I picked early April when they was really sprouts small, and you can eat them as salad. It's really tender.
The leaves.
Uh-huh, just leaves. And
only when it's young, right?
When they're young. And then when they're a little bit bigger, you can make kimchi out of those. And also you can blanch them and dry them, just like I talked about the fiddlehead. You keep the year-round, and then when you want to eat them, soaking in the water again, then satay, or you can make like we call the namu. And you just blanch them again, so soften, and you mix it up with the seasoning.
Do you bake the root? Do you roast
not
the root?
Roast them. Also, dandelion leaf, you roast them and make tea out of those. Supposed to be people has ulcer problem.
Ulcer problem?
Uh-huh, mm-hmm. They will cure for those. And also, dandelion root, wash really good, dry them. And you boil the water with it, and then you drink with it, or you just, when it was fresh, you chop it up really good, and soaking with honey, and leave it for about a year, and starting to eat with drink, or you can with smoothies, mix with it, and things
sweeten
like
up your
that.
Smoothie. Uh-huh. Yeah, thank
and
you.
Yes, so people has high blood pressure problem. People has ulcer problem, and people has also a diabetic problem that's supposed to be good for that.
I feel compelled to say we're not a medical physician. we're not giving you any advice, but this is these are the way
that's
these things
my
are considered.
Understanding.
Yes, exactly. Uh-huh. We've got a lot of callers and emails, so I'm just going to try to get to people so they get some answers to the questions. Barbara, I'd like to welcome you on Hometown Alaska. What's your question?
Hi, great. I just wanted to share some of the experiences that I've had. I've lived in Alaska 35 years, and I've, learned about blueberry picking and so on early on. But I participated in the Alaska Permaculture Guild's Alaska Food Challenge in 2011 and 12. And it was during that time that I learned so much about all the wonderful food that one can forage out in the wilderness and even in town, just by going out on foraging parties as small groups. So often would have somebody in the group that says, hey, let's go get such and such, and off we'd go. Mm-hmm. And it was awesome, and we tried to have a real plan, but then there were usually plan B, plan C, as well as that plan A, because sometimes you get to a place and not so productive or nothing. Someone else has been through there already and took everything. So we would generally have some optional plan so that we could find something.
That's a good suggestion.
Yeah, and I learned a lot from Janice Schofield's book, and I saw Lori Constantino at, I think it was a Botanical Gardens conference a few years ago, and she talked about, you know, spruce tips and devil's club tips and all kinds of good things. Mm-hmm. And so there's vegetable sorts of things to be gotten as well as berries. So it's fun to learn, okay, where are things out? And we sort of send out these emails to each other. Okay, well, right now there's this, this, and this available. And so we go out on these foraging parties. And then in a couple more weeks, okay, now what's open? You know?
Yeah, so it's kind of ongoing.
The whole season. Yeah.
Well, those are great suggestions, and I'm going to try to move on to a couple of emails that we've got, Barbara, but thanks for calling in, and thanks for making those suggestions. We have a quick mushroom question here. When this person cleans their mushrooms at home rather than in the field, and they throw the scraps out into the leafy debris, and they're wondering if it's going to take, they realize different environments, but they think they might have some new boletes coming up, and so they're excited, and they want to know if that's possible.
It's a long shot, but I certainly do the same.
Okay. Ever hopeful.
Exactly. It doesn't hurt.
Let's see. White ball-like mushrooms. What are they?
Puffballs would be my guess.
And what's the status on those?
Well, if they're true puffballs and they're fruiting above ground and they're soft and white in the inside, they're edible.
Say that again.
If they're true puffballs and they're growing above ground and they're soft and white on the inside, pure white, and they don't have a hard rind on the outside, and they're not growing in a contaminated area such as a roadside, then they're delicious.
Okay. Last question that's come in. Where is the best place and time to pick low bush cranberries? And we don't have much time. So if you have any suggestions, or I know I find them on the coastal trail going up toward Point Warrensop. So I don't know. Nope.
I find them usually in treed areas where there's no grasses growing in the understory, and it depends on the year when they get ripe. I found some this year that were ripe. It's really early for them, as Julie said, but they were at a low elevation, and they're usually a little bit later than now.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we probably have about a minute or so. I told our experts in the studio that they were going to get a moment to say something, but we run out of time, so sorry you don't. I think the one thing we actually have to tell people is what we've said throughout the show, which is if you don't know what you're eating or what you're holding in your hand, don't eat it. And there's lots of places you can go to find out what you've got. Are you going to say something, Kate?
Well, I can add Fungus Fair.
Oh, yes.
And Girdwood is an excellent place to learn your mushrooms if you're interested, August 22nd through 24th.
That's great. And Lori, what about you? Anything you want to say about all of this huge topic?
Well, foraging is the ultimate something for nothing, and very satisfying in that way.
Yeah, yeah. It's good on the budget.
Very good on the budget.
And nutrition-wise, we never really went into too much detail about nutrition, but nutrition-wise, it's rich, right?
Well, the New York Times had a story last year that dandelions have 7 times the phytonutrients of spinach.
Well, there you go. Okay, you hear the music coming in. I've got to say thank you to everybody. Special thank you to Janice Schofield, who called us all the way from New Zealand. Thank you, Janice.
Oh, thank you. It was wonderful being a part of this, and I'm just wonderful seeing, well, not seeing.
Not seeing us, but talking to us. All right. So thank you so much, and I want to thank Lori Constantino, Kate Moat, Christine Yee, and Julie Riley, who also called in just to give us a little berry report, and also to all our callers and the emails. They were really good and really made this a great show. Next week, Charles Wolfworth will be your host, talking about new school standards and testing with Anchorage School District Superintendent Ed Graff. Hometown Alaska is on the web at alaskapublic.org. You can join us on Facebook at Alaska Public. Pat Yak is Vice President of Public Media. Monica Goki is our web editor and audio engineer. Thanks so much for joining us today on Hometown Alaska. I'm Kathleen.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.